This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. A defiant Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he will not negotiate a further delay to Britain's departure from the European Union.
I will not negotiate a delay with the EU. And neither does the law compel me to do so. I will tell our friends and colleagues in the EU exactly what I have told everyone in the last 88 days that I've served as Prime Minister, that further delay would be bad for this country.
Parliament voted in favor of an amendment that withheld support for the Brexit deal. According to legislation, the vote means Johnson is obliged to write to the EU seeking a delay beyond Britain's scheduled departure date of October 31st. British opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn says he's happy with the decision to delay the vote.
I welcome today's vote. It's an emphatic decision by this House that has declined to back the Prime Minister's deal today and clearly voted to stop a no-deal crash out from the European Union.
Outside, tens of thousands of anti-Brexit demonstrators demanded a new referendum on whether Britain should leave the EU or remain. Syrian Kurdish-led forces and Turkey are exchanging blame for fighting that has rattled a U.S.-brokered ceasefire in northeastern Syria. The Kurds are appealing to U.S. Vice President Mike Pence to enforce the deal. The Syrian Democratic Forces say Turkey has failed to abide by the deal, refusing to lift the siege of a key border town. Turkey's defense ministry says it is completely abiding by the accord. South Sudan's opposition leader, Riek Machar, returned to his country Saturday. He is scheduled to meet with President Salva Kiir in a bid to form a unity government. The two leaders have less than a month to finalize the deal, according to a peace agreement signed a year ago. This is VOA News. Small groups of demonstrators gathered Saturday in central Beirut in an effort to keep Lebanon's anti-government protests going. Reuters' Emily Wither reports.
After another night of violent clashes across Lebanon, anti-government protesters gathered for a third day of rage Saturday in the biggest protest the country has seen in decades. Fueled by rising fury over an economic crisis, the Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri gave his government partners a 72-hour deadline Friday to agree on reforms, hinting he may otherwise resign. These latest protests kicked off over the rising cost of living and new tax plans. Hezbollah leader Saeed Hassan Nasrallah addressed supporters Saturday, saying the group opposed the government's resignation and that the country didn't have enough time for such a move, given the acute financial crisis.
That's Reuters' Emily Wither reporting. Lebanon's finance minister says he and the prime minister have agreed on a final budget that does not include any additional taxes or fees. Afghanistan's Independent Election Commission is confirming it has delayed the planned release of preliminary results of the September 28th presidential polls. The commission's chief is apologizing to Afghans for not being able to meet the deadline. She is promising to release preliminary results as soon as possible, but did not say exactly when. The mayor of riot-stricken Barcelona is pleading for calm after violent protests by Catalan separatists rocked the city for a fifth consecutive night. Reuters' Edward Barron has more on the rioting.
Streets in Barcelona were ablaze on Friday night as hundreds of protesters battled with police in the heart of Spain's most visited city. Fiery barricades were set up and rocks hurled at security forces. It was the fifth day of unrest following the jailing of Catalan separatist leaders. Officials said there were clashes in at least four other towns and cities in Spain's wealthiest region in the far northeast of the country. Spain's Interior Ministry said 207 police had been injured since Monday and 128 people had been arrested in the region over the past 5 days, as pro-independence anger shows no sign of abating.
That's Reuters' Edward Barron. Police are bracing for more protests in the coming days. Egypt's Antiquities Authority has revealed the details of 30 ancient wooden coffins recently discovered in the southern city of Luxor. Mustafa Waziri, Secretary General of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, says the coffins were for men, women, and children from the 22nd dynasty, dating back nearly 3,000 years. For all the latest news, please visit us at voanews.com or for news on the go, use the VOA mobile app. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
Provision has been made already in the budget for it, and the shortfall will definitely be covered by supplementary budget if they have to. But there were already budgetary provisions for it in the 2019 budget.
The Nigerian government and labor unions signed an agreement to expedite the implementation of the new minimum wage.
More than 80% of the population, not in Kwakali only, but among the whole the country, demonstrate on the street and say we not agree. That is very clear.
Guinean opposition groups meet representatives from the international community regarding the resolution of the ongoing political crisis.
Jammeh is an integral part of that regime, and rightly so, he should come to testify. Advancing is himself that is the best course of action to take.
And the Gambians express shock over the testimony of an ally, former President Yahya Jammeh. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nigerian government has signed an agreement with labor unions paving the way for the immediate implementation of an increase in the national minimum wage. The agreement was signed in the capital, Abuja, Friday. Months ago, President Muhammadu Buhari had signed into law a new minimum wage, which saw an increase from $50 to $82 per month. But the labor unions expressed concern that the implementation of the law has been too slow. To learn more about the new agreement, I reach Emma Ogbuaja, General Secretary for the Nigerian Labour Congress.
It's an agreement reached between the federal government and its own workers. You recall that in April, the president signed a new minimum wage law that placed the least paid worker in Nigeria at 30,000 naira a month. And there then needed to be a consequential adjustment because with that, several debt levels were then disclosed. But the discussions with regards to having the adjustment took a long while. The two central labor organizations in Nigeria, the NLC and the TUC, receiving reports from our affiliates had to intervene. It was that intervention that led us to issuing communication to the Secretary of the Government of the Federation, drawing his attention to undue delay in having this consequential adjustment that would have smoothened the complete implementation of the law.
We heard reports that Nigerian workers were particularly displeased with what some people described as inability to expedite the implementation of the agreed 30,000 naira minimum wage. What do you make of this displeasure of public workers who said it should have been implemented a long time ago?
There are two streams with regards to the implementation. The law is already on, and automatically the lowest paid worker from that April started earning 30,000 in compliance with the law. So that distorted the salary structure, and there was the need to have an understanding. It was a challenge of having a table that would sit both the government and the rest of the workforce that needs to be delayed. There was no way the workers were going to take an award. We thought it had to be a product of collective bargaining. The government initially wanted to make an award, and we thought that shouldn't be. It is still operate from April. Whatever constitutional adjustment that has been arrived at now will be implemented from April. So there definitely will be arrears. That will be covered.
Where do Nigerian workers go from here following the agreement on Friday?
To get back the issue of the minimum wage and the consequential adjustment have been put behind us. But that doesn't mean that it's a guru or eureka for the Nigerian worker, because the pressure come to bear on the worker with regards to the challenge in the increase in petroleum prices, increase in tariffs for electricity, position of the government to increase the value-added tax by almost 50%, and the general law in the economy, our fear is that this might still not get the worker out of the working poor status.
How soon will this agreement be implemented?
Implementation takes immediate effect, but we still expect to recover the arrears that has accrued from April till the 18th that we signed the agreement. But it will be immediate effect. Provision has been made already in the budget for it, and the shortfall will definitely be covered by supplementary budget if they have to. That there were already budgetary provisions for it in the 2019 budget.
Emma Ogboaja is the General Secretary for the Nigerian Labour Congress. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Representatives from Guinean opposition parties have met officials from the international community about the ongoing crisis in the West African country. According to Sidia Touré, leader of the Opposition Union of Republican Forces Party, the international community called for a political dialogue to resolve the ongoing crisis. Opposition and civil society groups have organized demonstrations to protest what they said are plans by President Alpha Condé to seek additional terms when his 2 5-year terms expires. Sidia Touré tells me the crisis can only be resolved after President Condé promises to step down after his term expires, as stipulated in the constitution.
So the meeting was held on Wednesday. So it was ambassador of United States, from the European Union, from France, United Nations, and ECOWAS. They just want to know what is the situation in the country today, and all the demonstration, and what is the solution to go through. So they have a discussion, and after that, I think you have they release a communique, you know, trying to say that they want in Guinea to accept that people can go on demonstration in the street. They have to accept that opposition has right to, and we have to find a way to negotiate a solution for the country.
Are you willing, you and your other colleague, Sello Dalein Diallo, to engage the government in a constructive dialogue to resolve this ongoing political crisis?
From the arrival of Mr. Condé on power in Guinea in 2010, we have had more than 5 negotiations. There is no solution anyway. We're always talking about politics. Those guys are not respecting the law, and when they do so, they ask you to go to negotiation. When you finish the negotiation, nothing has come. They want to organize the legislative election for Congress, you know. But we didn't finish the former election for mayor yet. So we have to finish that. And before I engage a new election, we can sit down and take, you know, a position to about this matter.
So what is your reaction to the communique issued by the international community, including ECOWAS, the European Union, the United Nations, and officials from the United States?
We agree with that, because this is the situation in Guinea today. You cannot go to sleep to demonstrate, and you cannot find a solution, you know, to respect the law of the country. The main discussion is about our constitution. Our constitution is very clear. Every president has 2 mandates and not more. This guy wants to have a 3rd mandate. He wants to have 3rd term. And there is no solution for that. You know, this is the only thing we can do, is everybody in Guinea has to respect the constitution, and things will be okay for everybody.
President Condé has said that it is the people of Guinea who will decide whether he stays for additional terms or not. Don't you think that is reasonable? If the people of Guinea say he should not stand for it, then he would not stand. But if
majority of the people want him to seek additional terms because of what he is doing for the people. Don't you think he should seek additional terms because the people want him to do so?
We are the people of Guinea, and we decide we're not ready for that. One. Two, we have the constitution. And this constitution is Article 154. Nobody can have more than two terms. And nobody can change the republic from people to have a meeting to discuss or asking people of Guinea, we want to change the country to become, a kingdom. That's not possible, you know. We are the people. And we demonstrate last Monday, more than 80% of the population, not in Conakry only, but among the whole the country, demonstrate on the truth and say we not to agree. That is very clear.
So what is the opposition coalition and civil society groups think is the best solution to resolve this ongoing political crisis in Guinea?
The best way is Mr. Conde say that he will respect the constitution of the country. The constitution he's standing on once and twice, you know, I think this is very clear.
After the demonstrations the entire week, what is next? What is going to happen next week?
Next week, Monday, we will bury the 10 people who was killed during those demonstrations. I can tell you that nobody needs to kill people when they go to demonstration on the streets. You can say in Algeria, we are demonstrating more than 6 months, nobody was killed. So first, when we finish with burying of those people, Monday or Wednesday, we'll go to demonstration again. We will ask them to allow them to demonstrate and just to have, walk on street. If they want, we will be maybe 1 million people to do so, but they will not accept. If they accept it, there will be no problem. We will just walk on the street and go home.
Sidi Ature is the leader of the Guinean Opposition Union of Republican Forces Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Conakry. A prominent Gambian human rights campaigner says people were shocked about the testimony of an ally of former President Yahya Jammeh at the recent hearing of the Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission, or TRRC. Madi Jobate says there appears to be a section of the population who want the TRRC to invite former President Jammeh to testify before the commission. Former military junta vice chairperson Edward Singate testified this week before the TRRC about his role in human rights abuses during Jammeh's rule. For additional reaction regarding Singate's testimony before the TRRC, I reached human rights campaigner Madi Jobate in the capital, Banjul.
Duarte is one person that many have held as being responsible or a leading player in the July 22 coup and then what followed, establishing or strengthening that regime. But his testimony yesterday just merely confirmed what people held, just that it gave more details as to his specific role, or actions in the course of all things. Even his testimony, many also have doubts about it because it appeared he tried to minimize his role and actions, the atrocities that were committed, his role and participation there. So he seemed to take a general responsibility as a member of the council, as people who led the coup. But when it comes to specific actions like the killings, the tortures, in most of the cases he would claim to be present, to be part of the decision making, but then when the actual act comes, he did not take part in that act.
Madi, some people are saying that it was a clear case of him using his legal training to evade responsibility, although he says he was part of the decision-making process. What do you make of it?
For me, even without the legal training, if one has been able to for Edward Singate from the very beginning of this coup and through his tenure in that regime until he came out, until now, you would not be surprised that this guy is not going to be one that would be easily caught unawares or would be made to take responsibility. Because indeed he has a very smart yet cunning character. The strategy he has used, his demeanor, his body language, with his words, the words he uses and how he uses them, in a strategic way that to me was merely to really disarm the lead counsel and to discredit him, and thereby giving him a positive image as someone who has come to tell the truth but is being prevented from saying his story by the lead counsel. So he's played a very strategy tactics that tells me, even if he didn't study law, that is his character. And that makes it difficult, therefore, to get the truth out of him or to make him take responsibility for things that, you know, he definitely should take responsibility.
Now, Madi, some people are saying his two-day testimony also implicated former President Yahya Jammeh of playing a key role in the execution or gross human rights violations during his presidency. What do you make of it?
Edwards gave the bulk of responsibility to Jammeh and the former vice chair, Jammeh, Senator Sabin. So the decisions that we are taking are, as far as he's concerned, taken collectively, all right? And then any order is either given by Jammeh particularly, or any other action was unilaterally taken by Senator Sabin. So, for example, when they are going to crush that so-called counter coup on November 11, he said they, as a council, decided that they are going to crush it. But then another order came when they were leaving from Jammeh that take no prisoners, all right? And so when they went to the barracks now to confront the alleged coupist, his entire narration is that either Sana Sabani gave the order or, the other soldiers did the shooting or chased these other soldiers, and he was there in the line. Everybody was shooting, but he did not shoot, you know. And so he played it that way, so that ultimately what came out is that it's Yahya Jammeh and Sana Sabani taking the bulk of the responsibility, and his complicity is simply because he was part of the council and a particular decision was taken as a group.
Now, let me ask you this. Some are also saying that the testimony so far has generated interest for calls for the TRRC to invite former President Yahya Jammeh to come and also testify, although there are some concerns that if he gets in or he returns to face the TRRC, he could be arrested and possibly prosecuted. Talk to me about this.
Well, the TRRC, the whole concept of the transfer justice process, really, is to understand this dictatorship. And therefore, Jammeh is an integral part of that regime. And rightly so, he should come to testify, either advising himself that is the best course of action to take, or the, you know, TRRC, I would expect that by now they have contacted him or attempted to contact him to come and testify.
Madi Jobate is a prominent Gambian human rights campaigner. He spoke with me from Banjul. A newly released Afrobarometer poll shows Botswana's governing party, or the Botswana Democratic Party, BDP, will win the upcoming general election by a landslide. This, despite reports that Wednesday's poll is expected to be the most competitive. It comes after former President Serete Kama Ian Kama resigned from the ruling party following a fallout with President Mokgweetsi Masisi over sharp policy differences. The former president has since been campaigning for the opposition ahead of the vote. For reaction to the Afrobarometer poll, I reached Biggie Butali, leader of the opposition Botswana Patriotic Front, or BPF, a breakaway group from the ruling party.
Well, the Afrobarometer survey is a very strange one. It's not scientific and it is very flawed. Firstly, they have a sample of 1,000 people out of a total registered number of 900,000. And these 1,000 polled, some of them are not even registered voters. Secondly, the questions they asked them were totally misleading. Having done that, about 20% of the people polled did not want to give which party they were going to support. So It is a totally flawed survey, and people should just ignore it. I don't know what they were up to.
Are you therefore faulting the way they carried out the survey? Because Afrobarometer has been consistent with its scientific surveys across Africa and
people have proved it to be legitimate and have been using their findings in policy decisions and all that.
Yes, that's why I'm saying I don't know why they had to change the methodology now. And even apart from that, they were asking people, which party do you support? And that's different from asking them, who are you going to vote for? Because if you say to me, which party do you support, I'll give you my party, but it's not necessarily who I'm going to vote for. So, like I said, the methodology was totally strange, and you should just discount it. The ruling party, come October 24th, will be no more.
Now, I understand it's going to be competitive. However, some are suggesting that these findings by Afrobarometer could undermine the so-called momentum that the Umbrella Coalition or the Opposition Coalition has in the run-up to the election. How do you respond to that?
It could have, but fortunately or interesting enough, the intelligence services have leaked. I don't know whether they leaked it or somebody from the ruling party leaked a survey that they did, and it showed that we're going to have a hung parliament. And this is in the headline news now in one of the leading newspapers in Botswana. So, and what the intelligence services have said is what we have always said, that we're going to have a hung parliament and the ruling party won't have a majority. So maybe this has ameliorated this dishonesty by Afrobarometer.
So what is the latest development in terms of the cooperation with the UDC, the Umbrella Party? How are you going to present yourself or candidates ahead of the elections next week?
Well, we are in what we call a strategic alliance, and it's coming along fine. So far, so good. We have not had any disagreement, and we are just 6 days away from the elections. We hope that next week, Wednesday, October 23rd, Botswana will be able to cast our votes, and we are expecting, like we said, to have the absolute majority, a number of seats, even though we will not cross the 50% threshold to win outright. Then we'll have to sit down and talk to the smaller parties and see if we can come up with a coalition government. But October 23rd, like I said, the ruling party will no more be the ruling party. The longest reigning ruling party in Africa will be in opposition.
What entails in this strategic alliance that you spoke about, and what influence or impact do you think former President Ian Khama is going to have because of his promise to vote for the opposition and campaign for the opposition for next week's elections?
Well, Ian Khama's role in the coalition has been really awesome because he's a man of great energy. He has been holding upwards to 8 rallies in 8 different places every single day. And traditionally, rallies are held on Friday, Saturday or Sunday in Botswana, and are usually held in the afternoon. But he has come up with a new method of campaigning where we have rallies from 8 in the morning right up to the evening. 8 rallies a day. It has never been done before and has been able to cover so much ground. Whilst the ruling party has stuck to the traditional weekend rallies. And because of that, I think he has been able to reach more people, particularly in the rural areas. And even apart from that, his own charisma and popularity should tip the scales over for the opposition.
Biggie Butale is the leader of opposition Botswana Patriotic Front, or BPF, a breakaway group from the ruling party. He spoke with me from the capital, Habaroni.
Yes. It's the weekend. Hey there, this is Heather Maxwell. Do you really want to enjoy yourself? I can help you with that. You don't even have to leave your home or spend a single cent. Just tune in to your local radio station this Sunday and listen to Music Time in Africa. 55 minutes of commercial-free Pan-African music, exclusive interviews, and music news. This Sunday's playlist features amazing music from 12 different countries. Song of the week is Je suis Africain by the late Rachid Taha from Algeria. African. And my vintage tune takes you back to 1983 Ghana. Yenti by Smart Nkanza and Becky B. Yenti. So don't miss it. Music Time in Africa, 1505 or 2005 Universal Time.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Kate Schechter is the Chief Executive Officer of World Neighbors, an Oklahoma City-based nonprofit organization. Its program espouses a long-term holistic approach to help strengthen needy communities to overcome hunger, poverty and disease. Ms. Schechter's experience include over 22 years working for various organizations, including an international nonprofit organization focused on global health, the World Bank, a leading foundation, and several respected universities, including Columbia and Harvard. She recently returned from a trip to Burkina Faso, where World Neighbors currently works in villages as well as in Mali. She joins me live here in the studios. Hello, Dr. Schechter, and welcome to Nightline Africa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So talk to me about your trip to Burkina Faso. How did Ouagadougou treat you?
Well, I was there in 2015, and this was my first time back since then. And I have to tell you that there is palpable tension now that wasn't there 4 years ago. People are nervous. They are avoiding being gathered in front of, you know, a restaurant or a hotel. There's a lot more guards, a lot more soldiers at the airport. And in some of the areas where we work in the countryside, there are curfews now.
So is this security situation currently affecting the work you're doing there?
Well, it does affect us more, I would say, in Mali than in Burkina Faso. Luckily, we have not had any situations where villages where we work have been in danger in Burkina Faso. But in Mali, there have been some villages nearby to where we work that have been attacked. And so we've started to encourage gatherings only in areas that we think are safe.
So what has been the response, particularly in Burkina Faso, concerning the work you're doing there?
We have to continue to work, and we are continuing to work, but there's very close relationship with the municipal government and with the national government to ensure that both our staff who work out of Ouagadougou are not going on, not traveling unless there's really a sense that it's going to be okay. Looking for routes that have not been targeted so that when they go to Mali, they often have to take a longer route, but one that we feel is safer. But luckily, in the communities themselves, we feel that people are pretty aware of how to protect themselves and are being very careful, but also continuing to do. I mean, you can't stop growing food and taking care of your livestock and, you know, just living your life.
So what impact do you think your program is having on these individuals that you work with in both Burkina Faso and in Mali?
Well, the key to our approach is to look at, as you mentioned earlier, all the needs and all the things that need to be addressed so that when we finish working with these communities, they're able to be on their own. And that includes not just working on agriculture. Of course, you know, these are both highly agrarian societies, so we do a big focus on sustainable agriculture, and we work on water issues, making sure that they are retaining water when it rains so that they have it year-round, helping them to grow crops that are more resilient so that they have food security year-round. We have a type of kale that's being grown that now produces kale for 8 months out of the 12. So that we're continuing to work to find crops that are resilient and can provide for long periods of time. We do a lot of work on financial literacy, but also helping people to create their own savings and credit groups so that they're raising money themselves, loaning to each other, and amassing capital together. And that is primarily focused on women who often don't have any access to funding, and that allows them to start their own enterprises, buy small livestock, and to learn how to really expand their capacity to live better lives and get out of poverty. I think that the the main point I want to make to you today is that by creating all of this capacity, by creating this knowledge and this self-sufficiency, we're also helping young people to stay in their communities and not to necessarily, you know, sort of drift towards the main cities and then get in trouble with not being able to find work and just getting frustrated and often being tempted into groups that might offer them a salary, but in response, you know, they'll have to join some kind of fundamentalist group or worse than just a fundamentalist group. And so I think that's really one of the most important things that we're contributing right now in terms of all of this effort. Yes, it's a holistic effort to help people's lives improve, to make sure they have food, water, security, education, etc. But it's also helping people to stay in their communities, to become leaders in their communities, and to fight the scourge of terrorism.
So far, are you seeing an expansion of this program, particularly in both Burkina Faso and Mali, to areas where there's also poverty or where people need it?
Yes. In fact, that was why I went on this trip. We were very fortunate to get a grant from an organization in Oklahoma City, and we're going to be partnering with another group that works both in Mali and Burkina Faso, and the plan is to expand. One of the strategies that we use that's been very effective, World Neighbors has been around for 68 years, and it's a tried-and-true methodology, is to have communities teach their neighboring communities what they've learned, so that even though we're a pretty small organization and we have a pretty small staff, we use a lot of volunteers and we help create community-based organizations who basically lead the process of development. And so through that kind of organic growth, we, and with this new funding, we'll be able to really reach thousands of people in the next 5 years.
Is there also a plan to partner with other NGOs to expand this effort to improve the lives of people in other ways, in other places that you might not have gotten to, both in these countries?
Absolutely. And we're working with a group called Groundswell International, which actually is people who split off from World Neighbors and started their own organization. So we're very compatible with each other. We agree about what works and what doesn't. And by working with them, we're going to be able to reach a lot more communities. We don't overlap right now, so that makes it just that much more effective to work together. But there are other organizations, both local NGOs, but also there's a group called ProLinova, which is a network of farmers who do sustainable agriculture around the world. And we are working with them. We're working with the UN agencies that focus on food security. So we are very much in the business of looking for partners and leveraging what we do to add to what other people are doing.
What has been the cooperation or assistance from the respective governments, as well as, you know, like the community elders in helping you with what you want to achieve in the lives of these people?
That's the key. And World Neighbors never tries to work under the radar. We always have an agreement with every national government that where we work. We work in 13 countries around the world. And so we both have cooperation from the national government, but more importantly from local government, municipal government, and making sure, as I said earlier, you know, keeping in touch about security issues, but also making sure that they know what we're doing and trying eventually to have the government take over some of the functions. For example, in healthcare, we're not in the business of supplying any kinds of salaries or anything like that. We want those salaries to be paid by the government because ultimately that's where they should be coming from. And you know, in education, again, we need to tap into what is happening on the local level and help these communities to get that support from their own government, both national and local. So that's a key process that we help facilitate. But, you know, unfortunately in both countries, at this point, that is not where the focus is. And so you need external organizations to come in and help with these basic social issues.
Talking about focus, do you think these governments would have the political will to at least listen to you and provide additional security to protect some of what you're doing and the individuals as well to help in entrenching the work you're doing?
Absolutely. And I've met with the governor of one of the regions where we work to talk about that very issue. I mean, it's a big concern for them. If they don't worry about that, it's their livelihoods as well that are in danger. So there is a big concern, and there is a willingness to work together. But of course, you know, resources are always the excuse for why things aren't being done.
So before we go, tell me, what are your expectations for the program, probably in the next 5 to 10 years' time? What do you want to see?
Well, I would like to see each one of these community-based organizations get out on their own, figure out how to reach out to both governments, but also other NGOs, UN agencies, to get funding. Because let's be honest, I mean, we can only help them so far, and then they're going to have to figure out how to be self-sufficient. And I think a lot of that is about knowledge, how to write a proposal, how to go before a government official and negotiate for assistance. So I'm looking forward to seeing these communities become self-sufficient. And I'll just tell you, around the world, we do this all the time, and it works beautifully. I was just in Kenya after I went to West Africa, and I met with community groups that are now consulting, that have their own enterprises, that have split off from World Neighbors. They don't get any assistance from us anymore, but now they're doing what we did. They're teaching other people and getting paid for it. That's what I'd like to see happen in these countries.
Kate Schechter is the Chief Executive Officer of World Neighbors, an Oklahoma City-based nonprofit organization. She joined us live from the VOA studios here in Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from African Collection. You're hearing Rema with Touch My Body, Timaya featuring Ali Kiba with Number One Come Next, and then Nadia Mukama featuring Arrow Boy with Radio Love. Singer comes next with Teyamo, and then Makoma Napesi, South Africa, will end it all for us.
You love me. You be my papa, mama, boy. You be my kind of healing me. The way you smile is a healing. My boy, nobody is healing. Don't you worry, boy. I belong to you and you belong to me. Your love is unstoppable. Baby, I never, never, ever hurt you or ever, ever leave you. Hey. Time if I did to come, how much you love me.
Make me wanna ding, ding, dong. Every day she a calling up my phone, say she wants some good, good love. Hey. I saw me hook her back, ding, ding, dong. She said she want a good, good loving, so me give her some good, good love. Hey.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, cheers, I'm ready, your love. Oh,
ukicheza radio love nyumbani mimi ende na yeye ukicheza radio love.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, if your sister is in the group of singing girls, your name always comes into the song. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.